We wrapped up another month on Tuesday, June 30th on Connecticut Today. We spoke with a representative from the Pacific Legal Foundation in the 3 o'clock hour about all the cases that have been decided so far and those yet to come of the controversial type from the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us in the 4 o'clock hour was Tom Breen, the managing editor of the New Haven Independent, to talk about all the controversy in the Elm City and also all around Connecticut regarding statues of Christopher Columbus. How about those who sit on the United States Supreme Court, the SCOTUS, as it's called in news parlance, gets very active this time of the year because they all want to hightail it out of D.C. for the summer, hand down the tough decisions, and then bolt till first Monday in October. Joining us to talk about the Supreme Court right now, senior attorney and expert on all things legal from the Pacific Legal Foundation. We've had him on before. Mark Miller. Mark, hi. Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Hi, very good. Thanks, Paul. Always a pleasure to join you.
And, Mark, this is the time of the year, right? I love how the justices put off the real sticky kind of scenarios here till the end before they hightail it to the summer. So this is the kind of the year that we see the real contentious, high-profile decisions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this year is similar to past years where, just as you said, they've put off some of the toughest cases to the end. In fact, because of COVID-19, the pandemic, we have a few more cases to go. It would be expected that we'll probably see a few opinions in July, which is unusual, not unheard of, but is unusual and certainly understandable in light of having to deal with the pandemic.
I wonder why, you know, Mark, they don't tackle the tough stuff first and leave the easy stuff till the end. I would think, Mark, I don't know whether you agree with me on this, that there's probably a little bit of a timing in a, not just in an election year, but kind of a timing in a political angle there, like, let's do the controversial stuff late, we'll run out of the room and let everybody scream about it. Yes or no? What do you think?
Well, that's true. You know, you could, a cynic could say they're going to get out of here. In fact, many of them in non-pandemic years go to Europe and teach or go on sabbatical for the summer. But on the other hand, you could say that the easy cases, which is the vast majority, and easy is probably not a fair thing to say. These are cases that are complicated and complex, but ultimately the court decides them unanimously. So easy in the sense that they don't have to negotiate on votes. Those cases tend to be the vast majority of the court's docket. It's only these last few cases each year where there is contentiousness and disagreement among the justices that they take more time because, if you know, perhaps a cynic would say they're trading votes. Maybe you give me this, I'll give you that. Mm. Or maybe to be more optimistic, less cynical, they're just simply trying to make sure every T is crossed and I is dotted with their dissents. You know, some of these opinions have had every justice in the dissent writing their own dissent as to why they specifically are disagreeing with the majority. You know, you're not going to see that at the beginning of the term. It really only happens at the end with these kind of socially contentious cases.
And speaking of those cases, we'll get to them momentarily. The guest, senior attorney from the staff of the Pacific Legal Foundation, Mark Miller, and we'll talk about the foundation's work also when we come back. Mark Miller is the guest. We'll get to some of these decisions. One case that may be still pending or not involves what police did to a family here. This one, kids, is going to make your head spin. We had an interesting case, too, today about public money and private schools. So all that and more coming up straight ahead with Mark Miller. First, traffic and weather together on WICC. Joined once again by Mark Miller, senior attorney on the staff of the Pacific Legal Foundation. We've had the Pacific Legal Foundation folks on numerous times, very good at explaining what is going on with the high court. And, Mark, let's start with, I guess, a ruling that came down today, a 5-4 decision, what a surprise, regarding public money and funding for schools that may have a religious bent. Can you dumb that down for us? What does that mean?
Basically, this is a very important case when it comes to school choice. So, you know, that's one of those social hot button issues that our country fights about. The idea that should parents be able to choose where to send their schools and perhaps, you know, some of their tax money in some sense be returned to them so they can choose where their child goes to school, public or private, or you know, should children be locked into going to public schools unless their parents can afford to send them to private schools without that help from their tax money that they've already paid for the school system? And so in this case, the question was, if a parent, as part of a school choice program, has the ability to choose to send their kid to their child to a religious private school, is the state allowed to preclude you or prohibit you as a parent from taking that your tax money that you've sort of paid to the state that has now, it hasn't technically been paid to the state. There's actually third parties who were moving money around, but ultimately you're effectively getting some of your own tax money back indirectly and getting to choose where to send your kid to school. And some agencies here specifically were saying, you can choose where to send your kid to school, but not if it's a religious school, because that would violate the separation of church and state. Yeah. Those who believed in allowing to send your child to a private religious school or sectarian school thought that was a discrimination, that isn't a violation of separation of church and state, but rather was a violation of free exercise, that as long as you're being allowed to send your kid to a private school with some help, some taxpayer money, then you should get to choose any private school you want. And here, the Supreme Court, 5-4, in an opinion from Chief Justice Roberts, sided with the free exercise side. He said for the majority, which is, this was a classic 5-4 breakdown, the way ideologically the court does occasionally break down, he said that it would be discriminatory not to allow a parent to take that credit and apply it to allow their kid to go to a private sectarian or religious school.
So essentially then, Mark, the 5-4 majority saying that just because a school then has a religious affiliation or a religious bent, that doesn't mean it should be eliminated from the choice of when a parent or guardians or thereof can send their kids there using a school choice program.
Exactly. So if you're going to have a school choice program, and the state doesn't have to, but if the state is going to say, we're going to set up a mechanism where some monies that would otherwise be tax monies gets applied to allow parents to pick schools, in other words, give parents school choice for their children, then we can't discriminate among those schools and sort of single out the religious schools and say, you can't be helped, because that was creating an unequal playing field. Now, again, the state can choose not to do a school choice program at all. But the idea here is, if we give school choice, if you allow parents who otherwise couldn't afford to send their kids to private school by giving them some funding that otherwise would go into the tax coffers of the state, you're helping all parents, and you're not simply allowing the wealthier parents to send their kids to private school. You're trying to level the playing field for everybody.
So John Roberts, who one day was he had conservatives sticking pins in him because of the Louisiana or whatever state that was abortion case. Now he's back up on the pedestal on this one, right?
Well, definitely from a social conservative perspective.
Yeah.
You know, yesterday, June Medical, that was the case out of Louisiana. Social conservatives were unhappy. They felt because Chief Justice Roberts there was a concurrence with the four quote unquote liberals saying that an abortion clinic regulation that required abortion doctors to have admitting privileges at a local hospital before they could perform the abortions, he said that was unconstitutional, even though he said at the other side of his mouth, he thought that, in fact, it was constitutional. But he said, because 4 years ago we decided otherwise, I'm going to have to side with what I said 4 years ago was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really make a lot of intellectual sense there, and really the left and the right kind of agree. It wasn't intellectually perhaps the most defensible argument, but ultimately the Supreme Court, it ultimately comes down to who can count to five. And in this case, five justices said that the regulation was an unconstitutional restriction on what's now put in the 14th Amendment, the right to an abortion.
Mark Miller, you sent me information here, your staff did, regarding a case here that made my head spin, a family's home, a $500,000 home, that just, you say, got destroyed here by police. Now, has this case been decided yet? Are we still waiting on this one? And tell my audience about this. This one is unbelievable.
Yeah, very disappointing. And this could happen in Connecticut. It could happen really anywhere. This particular case was out of Colorado, the city of Greenwood Village. And so, you know, in light of what happened in Minnesota, you know, we're all very sensitive to police practices. In this case, called Leck versus City of Greenwood Village. It has to do with the police trying to capture a Walmart, somebody who robbed Walmart, who then absconded and ran into somebody's house. He had nothing to do with the owners of the house. They were innocent third parties. And the police decided strategically, rather than wait out the criminal who was hiding in the Lex house, L-E-C-H, Mr. and Mrs. Leck, instead of waiting him out, they decided they were going to take a tank they had, which is, you know, some surplus military equipment that many police departments and sheriff's departments across the country have now, you know, sort of military equipment rather than old-fashioned, you know, City of Mayberry, you know, Andy Griffith kind of police work. They decided to knock down the walls of the house, of the Lex house. And they caught the criminal, to their credit. You can't really argue with the results. But the family said, okay, that's good. We're glad you caught the criminal. We all need police to capture criminals. That's a good thing. But on the other hand, who's going to pay to fix our house? And their insurance wasn't going to cover it because the police were the ones who knocked it down, and insurance generally will exclude from insurance when the government orders something to be destroyed. So here they looked to the police department, and the police department sort of shrugged and said, no, we're not responsible. And so at Pacific Legal, we litigate for property rights. And so we helped defend, and we were, as friend of the court, the family, the Lex, we argued in their favor, along with a group called Institute for Justice, who represented the Lex. And we said to the court, of course, this is a good thing that the police caught this criminal, but everyone should have to pay to fix their house, you know, all the taxpayers, because they provided a benefit to everybody. And they shouldn't have to bear that burden alone. It doesn't make sense that their home was destroyed and now they're just left holding the bag when the city is, you know, the city police there in Greenwood in Colorado are the ones who decided to knock down the wall. But the court said, no, that this is a police power of the state, that somehow there's an exception to the Fifth Amendment when the government can take your property, has to pay you just compensation. Here they said, well, this isn't really a taking because the government's not going to keep the house. But that doesn't, that's a distinction that makes no sense. They destroyed your house. So, of course, they took it. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case. So that case will stand. And now we'll look for other examples. You know, this is how it works at the Supreme Court. You keep pitching at them until they decide to actually take a swing. So this happens across the country, and we're going to just try and find the right case to get the Supreme Court to take this issue.
A half million dollar home is almost is destroyed because the cops wanted to get a guy, and that's fine. And now it's too bad. And then these people are out $450,000. Oh my God.
Yeah. It's very, Paul, it's truly shocking, which is why we supported the Lex and, of course, the organization that we're representing them. We're a nonprofit. We have to pick our cases carefully, but we devoted quite a bit of time and money and effort to arguing in their favor at the Supreme Court, trying to convince the justices that this is a case they should hear. But unfortunately, they refused. They passed on it. Yep.
Mark, hang on. One more quick segment with you. Mark Miller is the guest. He is a senior attorney on the staff of the Pacific Legal Foundation. Quick break. Back to wrap it up with Mark after traffic and weather together on WICC. And a couple of more minutes with a gentleman who's been kind enough to join us this afternoon, Mark Miller, senior attorney on the staff of the Pacific Legal Foundation. Mark, before I ask you more about the SCOTUS, talk a little about, once again, your organization, what you do to my audience, and talk about what somebody can do if they think they may need some legal help from folks like you.
Thank you so much, Paul. Yeah, Pacific Legal Foundation is a nonprofit. We're a 501c3, which means we represent our clients for free. As a lawyer who used to work in private practice, I can tell you my clients love me now because we don't charge them anything. And what we do and what we do at Pacific Legal is we represent individuals and small business owners who are in disputes with the government. That could be your local government, your state government, or your federal government. Or if you have another government, we'll sue them too. It's usually about your property rights. It's usually you want to do something reasonable with your property, and the government won't allow you, and we think unreasonably won't allow you to, and unconstitutionally, because ultimately we are constitutional lawyers. And so we try to win for our clients, and the reason we represent them for free is we're, number one, trying to win the case for them, of course. That always comes first. But number two, we're trying to set a precedent that will be applicable either in your local city or in your state, or even better, across the country at the U.S. Supreme Court. We're 12-2 at the Supreme Court. We've won 12 out of the 14 cases we've argued there, including recently. And the idea is to set precedents that allow people to live with a little bit more freedom, a little bit more of that liberty that our founding fathers believed in and based the country on.
course, we're always trying to perfect, always trying to improve upon. But that's what we do at Pacific Legal. If you have a dispute with your government, particularly on property rights, but it also could be maybe you have a business license that the government's giving you a hassle about, or maybe free speech issues, you can reach out to Pacific Legal at pacificlegal.org, and we'll have a way you can get in touch with us, and we'll review your case for free. And, of course, like I said, if we take it on, we'll represent you for free as well.
Excellent. Pacific Legal at pacificlegal.org. Mark, finally, what are we still waiting for from the Supreme Court? Any key cases still in the basket?
Certainly. The cases that I think jump to everybody's mind right now would be the series of cases that are thought of. I think there's two of them that have to do with the trying to get President Trump's tax returns. You've got a case out of New York where the New York attorney for the state of New York, for the city, wants his tax returns. And then you have Congress that wants the president's tax returns. And the argument the president is making, and they're trying to get the tax returns from banks and from other holding companies that have information about his companies, not just about the president's personal taxes, but also his business taxes. And the Supreme Court is sitting on that. The idea is the president and his sort of business organizations above the law? And I would predict that the court is going to say, of course, that the president is not above the law. We know that already because of cases like U.S. v. Nixon and the President Clinton's Monica Lewinsky debacle. But the question is going to be, what does the Congress or what does a state attorney or district attorney in New York have to show in order to get those records from these third parties, from these banks or other investment companies that have records related to the president's taxes? So that's the big case. Those are the big cases, I think, where we're waiting on.
Mark Miller, thank you as always. Folks, check him out, pacificlegal.org, the Pacific Legal Foundation. Mark, be good. Have a happy weekend. Happy 4th to you. We'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. Take care.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Mark Miller there, senior attorney on the staff at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Check him out. pacificlegal.org is the website if you want to send them an explanation of a problem you're having. As he said, they primarily take on property issues when you, as a property owner, be it commercial or residential, and you are battling city hall, town hall, the state government, and you feel that you're getting stepped on as a little person, they go to bat. And what they say their percentages in front of the Supreme Court, 12-2. Not too bad. If you're a pitcher, 12-2 in your first 14 games, if we ever have baseball again, you're a $30 million a year guy. Right on top of this with breaking stories throughout the day, live video too. I was watching it. The managing editor of the New Haven Independent, you can check him out, newhavenindependent.org. Tom Breen is the guest. Hey, Tom, Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on the show, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tom, thank you, and you guys, the way you covered New Haven was great. You know, Tom, you look around the state, the statue was quietly removed in Norwalk. People here in Bridgeport, in the Bridgeport area, still kind of figuring out what to do. All sides are, you know, talking with each other. It went predictably quiet in Hartford, quiet in Middletown. It's staying in Waterbury and Torrington. But, boy, Tom, no surprise that things were less than quiet in New Haven, huh?
Yeah, you know, I'm really glad that this is where you're starting because I think a lot of people in New Haven feel that it didn't have to turn out the way that it did. It's kind of an unfortunate confluence of events. And maybe if I could just lay out the timeline
to
how things ended up as volatile and tumultuous as they did.
And Tom, also,
when the statue was taken down.
Yeah, and Tom, also, if you could, because I grew up in New Haven, outline for people who may not have yet ever been there or go there, the kind of area this is. I know well about Worcester Square, but I think that has a lot to do with kind of the changing world we're in.
Yeah, sure. So Worcester Square is a neighborhood adjacent to downtown. It is New Haven's Little Italy, but increasingly the historically Italian-American part of town, as, you know, with many, many city centers throughout the country, especially in the Northeast, a lot of the Italian-American population that used to live in Worcester Square that kind of built the industrial corridor that it was when Worcester Square was filled with garment factories and other industry. You know, a lot of that population has moved out to the suburbs over the past 40, 50 years, and Worcester Square has become a much younger, a much more diverse, ethnically diverse, and also it's, you know, it has become a bit, it's not a rough and tumble industrial area. It's one of the pricier places in town. So it has a bit of the kind of toniness of any downtown that is flourishing with lots of real estate money, but it's definitely no longer, in terms of the people who actually live in Worcester Square, it is no longer as dominated by an Italian-American presence as it was 100 years ago, 70 years ago, 60, and so on. So the Worcester Square, and also Worcester Square is, you know, one of the kind of prettier and more scenic parks in mm-hmm. town. So the statue of Christopher Columbus stood at the southern end of it for over 100 years, since 1892. And there, you know, for the past, I'd say, 20 years in New Haven, there has been a small but vocal movement, especially among immigrant rights activists, to rename Columbus Academy, to either take down the statue or to put it in much more context as part of a kind of broader, I'd say, American reawakening to Columbus's much more complicated and at times very bloody history. So that movement didn't, you know, really go mm-hmm. anywhere up until, yeah. you know, we've seen this nationwide rethinking of which histories are memorialized, what is appropriate in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd. So on June 15th, a high school student who grew up in Worcester Square started a petition calling for the statue to be taken down. Very quickly, she garnered something like 2,000 signatures, including from some of the more historic Italian-American organizations and the political leaders in the neighborhood. The Parks Commission, the city's Parks Commission, voted just a few days later to take down the statue. And since this is a city park and a city-owned statue, it's ultimately city property. So this petition goes out, the City Parks Commission votes to take it down, and then a week passes. And I think that that's where a lot of people feel that, you know, things could have gone a little bit differently. Between the city's formal announcement that the statue was coming down and when it actually came down, mm-hmm. there was a full week. And I think the people who wanted the statue to stay, the people who wanted to have it go, really had a lot of time to sit and stew and think about how they were going to protest for or against it. And a lot of people say if it had come down kind of immediately in the day or two after the Parks Commission voted, maybe you wouldn't have had the tumultuous fight that did break out when it actually came. But instead, it came a week later. And on top of that, the cranes showed up a couple hours late. So you had a lot of angry people kind of waiting for it to come down a lot of time for them to get angry over.
Yeah. Tom, hang on. Great stuff so far. We'll be right back. Tom Breen, the guest, the managing editor of the New Haven Independent, talking about the Christopher Columbus statue coming down in New Haven. And folks all over the state were watching video from TV and from sites like the New Haven Independent, where things got about as angry as they did in Connecticut over the Columbus statue. More with Tom Breen straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together, 4:36 on WICC. Tom Breen, the guest, the managing editor of the New Haven Independent. Check him out, newhavenindependent.org, one of the best micro sites, I guess, local, hyper-local news sites in the country. Tom Breen and Paul Bass, old friend of mine there from radio and print days, got on this early on the hyper-local site trend, and the New Haven Independent does it about as well as anybody. Hey, Tom, you know what's interesting? I don't think, Tom, anybody quite realized who, for lack of a better term, who wasn't Italian or isn't Italian or isn't connected to that culture in some way. I think, Tom, and I don't know whether you thought this, I think that a lot of people may have been surprised, Tom, not just in New Haven, but all across the country in the year 2020, how much the image of Christopher Columbus is still kind of a vestige of Italian pride.
Yeah, you know, thank you for the kind words about the Independent. Very much appreciate it. I'm glad to hear mm-hmm. you appreciate the work that we do. I think that did, you know, I would say what really set off, so ultimately the conflict that we've been kind of hinting around but haven't yet kind of described, or at least I haven't described kind of in full detail yet, is that, you know, some critics of the Columbus statue in New Haven showed mm-hmm. up, some young men of color. There were two of them. There were probably about 40 older Italian-Americans who were very much wanted the statue to stay. The critics, you know, one was using, you know, some pretty strong language, but ultimately they wanted to talk about how Christopher Columbus the kind of memorialization of Christopher Columbus represented a kind of assimilation into whiteness for mm-hmm. Italian Americans at a time in the late 19th century when yeah. a lot of Southern Europeans in particular were thought of as other than the, you know, predominant WASP culture.
Sure.
And let me say that used, you know, one thing that I think white people in general are terrible at is kind of recognizing whiteness as something that exists. And the language got harsh and they may not have liked a sign or two, but that talk about what it means to be white and the role that Christopher Columbus, especially memorials to Columbus, may have played in helping kind of mainstream this mm-hmm. foreign ethnic identity in the late 19th century, I think that was a bit triggering for a lot of the people who really wanted the statue to stay, whether consciously or unconsciously. This was something that was a point of huge pride, and it also represented a kind of becoming a part of America that I think a lot of people did not want to see jettisoned.
And honestly, Tom, I'm 59, and Lord knows I'm Italian. I grew up in New Haven, whatever. But I was amazed. I sat back and I kind of said to myself, wow, just in Connecticut, I didn't think there were this many Columbus statues or memorials. I thought there were like two or three. But now when you think of it, Tom, I guess just about so many American cities, of mega cities, from New York with Columbus Circle and everything down to local cities and towns, I didn't realize how many of these statues and memorials to Columbus there actually are.
Yeah, and you know, we should remember that the United States, you know, what is now the United States, our kind of national interest in Columbus predates the influx of Italian American immigrants in the late 19th century. I mean, Columbia University in New York City,
yeah.
Columbia, Missouri, and, you know, all the different state capitals in Columbia. You know, Columbus was a figure who was not associated with Great Britain and was a figure kind of who was connected to this new world in some way and also of European descent and was a figure to, you know, for the founding fathers to celebrate. And I think that a lot of Italian Americans in the mid to late 19th century latched on to him as, you know, someone Italian by birth who sailed under the, you know, Spanish flag, mm-hmm. who was a way into the broader American story that was one that one could be proud of, almost regardless of his actual historical, you know, actions. I think that what we're seeing now today is, you know, much like we saw with the fight over Yale's Calhoun College a few
yep.
years ago, a fight over, you know, the Calhoun College was not named in the 1830s when Calhoun was alive. It was named in the 1920s at a time when Yale wanted to court Southern students. And so this, you know, the statue going up 400 years after Columbus sailed, these are all very symbolic fights, but also symbols mean a lot to people because it's how they connect to their stories of their past and how they relate to a broader community. So it makes sense that people will get so heated to me.
What is the temperature there in the general area of how Justin Elicker, the new mayor of New Haven, handled this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that this has been a challenging first 6 months for, you know, any elected leader. And this is, you know, the mayor's, you know, first 6 months in office. So he's had COVID-19, he's had the uprising against police brutality, and now the kind of fight over, you know, these symbolic statues and historical memorials. I think that on that day for this particular incident, the people on the scene were frustrated that the mayor was not there. He was in his office at City Hall. And I think they were frustrated with a lack of, you know, I can't imagine that people there would have greeted him too well, because a lot of people were unhappy that either he had supported the statue or hadn't taken it down quickly enough. Mm-hmm. But I think there was a general confusion as to what exactly was going to happen to the statue, where the crane was. You know, appeared to be a bit of a kind of vacuum of leadership in the park at that moment. There were certainly plenty of city employees and, you know, trying to find the crane, and it's not easy to lift up a 2,000-pound statue, so they're, you know, trying to get that work done. But I think that, you know, for a mayor who so far has really prided himself on transparency, on accessibility, I think there was some frustration in the park that day as to, you know, where the leadership around this issue was at that moment.
Tom, hang on one more segment with you, if you please, right after the break. Tom Breen, managing editor, New Haven Independent. Check him out, newhavenindependent.org, about the ruckus that happened when the Columbus statue came down in New Haven, about the hottest spot in all of Connecticut for this. So, Tom, hang on, back to you first. Traffic and weather together, and Wall Street coming up on WICC. And Tom Breen with a few more minutes today, kindly. He's been with us since 4:30 talking about the dust-up in New Haven, about the Columbus statue there in Worcester Square. He's the managing editor of the New Haven Independent. Check him out, newhavenindependent.org. Tom, so the statue now is in the KFC Museum, the Knights of Columbus Museum in New Haven. What happens to that pedestal now? And I know you guys have been covering what may be in the pedestal. What's going to be done? Update us on that.
So, it's very possible that you have more up-to-date information than I. But from what I understand, the statue is ultimately en route to the Knights of Columbus Museum. But
okay,
I think it still is in city storage.
I'm sorry, I meant it was going to end up there. Yeah.
I believe that's the ultimate destination, but I believe right now it's still in city park storage or public work storage somewhere in the city. Just yesterday, the mayor announced that he has appointed a 24-person committee that's comprised mostly of Worcester Square residents, politicians, and representatives from various Italian American societies to determine what will ultimately replace the statue. The pedestal is still there. And in fact, the New Haven Museum recently announced through their own archival research that the pedestal almost certainly holds a time capsule dating back to 1892 that was put in and likely contains some Spanish and Italian coins, some Italian language newspapers, and some other historical artifacts from that era. So hopefully we'll get to see what is in that time capsule, if indeed it's there sometime soon. But for now, the pedestal remains, the statue's in storage, and we've got a committee looking into what will replace the now-gone Columbus statue.
Interesting. And Tom, final question here. You talked about the role of Justin Ellicker, but boy, Rosa DeLauro, long, long, long time New Haven congresswoman who hails from that area. People may or may not know her mother was a New Haven power broker from that area for years. She kind of found herself caught in the political crossfire on all this, too, didn't she?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And she was another notable absence from that morning's fracas. So you had State Rep Robin Porter, State Senator Gary Winfield, Roland Lamar, Ellen Kupo, a lot of New Haven politicians who represent the city at the state level, but you didn't see the mayor and you didn't see Congresswoman DeLauro. And her mom and she were both fixtures of this neighborhood and of the Italian-American community in New Haven. I've got Rosa for years, really up until this year, argued against changing the name of Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day and against removing the statue. And here, through a statement released by email, she came out in support of it. I think she recognizes that that stance is just not a tenable one, considering where not just the city, but where the nation is right now in its reevaluation of these memorials. So she wasn't there, but a lot of people were talking about her.
Tom Breen, thank you so much. Managing editor, New Haven Independent, newhavenindependent.org. They update the site constantly during the day. A lot of video on that site, too. Also, streaming online radio there as well. Paul Bass and Tom Breen doing a great job there. Tom, thank you. We'll be in touch. Appreciate it. Have a happy weekend.
You as well. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Check them out, folks. newhavenindependent.org. Great site. Hyper-local on New Haven, but it's an interesting read. And I want them to have him on because, again, if you look at what went on around the state and is still going on, again, remember the discussion about the Bridgeport, I guess the hyper-local Columbus statue to Bridgeport, is still ongoing, which is good. There's been no, at least to my knowledge, there have been no rowdy protests there. It has not, I guess, been defaced in any way. And there are people on the city council now meeting and deciding, what to do, if anything. But we had the mayor of Norwalk on, Harry Rilling, a few days ago. He quietly removed the Columbus statue. It's been removed in Hartford. It was removed in Middletown. I guess it's staying in Waterbury, staying in Torrington, I think. But New Haven was kind of the epicenter for a lot of the anger.